I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and this is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. I arrive in Savannah, Georgia, in the middle of July, in the height of summer. I get in my car. I turn on the radio. The weatherman says it's 78 degrees outside, but that it feels like 103. I take the 405 north, towards Kalayo, a small town near South Carolina. I roll down the window. You can hear the cicadas and the noise that they make. It's somewhere between static and song. You hear them all over. They're everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And then it starts to rain, totally unexpected. And it rains like it's been raining for days. Hard, steady rain that floods the two-lane highway. And in minutes, I can't see a foot in front of my face. But by the time I reach Eva May, the clouds clear, and I walk across the street, and she greets me. She says I sounded older over the phone. And I ask her about the rain and the heat and how she deals with it. Is it normal for it to rain like that? Yeah, she says. The low country is God's country. And I never ask her how old she is, but I know that she's old enough to have gone to a segregated elementary school. She's wearing big opalescent pearl earrings that match her necklace, and bright red heels, and a flower print summer dress.
For me to be here, to be able to tell someone else.
We sit down in the kitchen and she tells me what it's like to be from this place. A population just north of 2,000 people, and just south of the South Carolina border. A place where several generations of families have lived and stayed.
My name is Eva May. I'm from Effingham County, Clio, Georgia. Country, you know, in the field, cotton, tobacco area. If you love, you know, being and having your own garden, your own chickens, your ducks, maybe dogs and cats and, you know, running around. Hear the birds and the squirrels running all around. It's all about nature and the beauty of God, you know, what he created. Everyone was family. And the area where I stayed at is called Berryville. My grandfather purchased the land from the Berries, and so we call it the Berryville community. Mm-hmm. And then he used to have a tobacco field, and he had a farm, and then he had a little store there too. And back then they used to have a thing called a little juke joint or whatever. Like hole in the wall. And they used to, you know, have parties and stuff on the weekend when they, you know, retired from the field that Friday night. And on a Saturday, they would get together and have their party. It was nine of us. Nine of us, and my mom was, well, I had a dad, but my mom did She was the man and the... She was more like the man and the wife, you know, because she did everything, you know.
I don't care if you're young or old. You ought to get together and let the good times roll.
She would always tell us, you know, that she wanted us three older ones to graduate, get an education, you know, and
if you want to have a ball, you got to go out and spend some cash and let the good times roll.
It was hard back then, no food holler to eat.
I'm talking about the good times. Well, it makes no difference whether you're young or old. All you got to do is get together and let the good times roll.
I started to work. I got a job and I started to work. I met my husband. I fell in love because of this cologne he used to wear, and he used to call it Jovan, J-O-V-A-N. And I just fell in love with him because it smelled so good. And he knew how to treat it, you know, treat a young lady.
Every woman's pièce de résistance. Wear Monsieur Jovan aftershave cologne and grow bold gracefully.
He used to go to my grandmother, take her to the doctor, and do a lot of things for her. Help her feed her chickens and do all this. And he did a lot for my uncles, my mom, my dad. He did a lot. He just was very nice. He was a very nice young man. He got a job in Savannah working with Great Dean Trailer Company, and I continued working as a housekeeper at a hotel in South Carolina. And we had a son, and he was like two, and we went to the bank and we purchased. They gave us a loan to get a trailer. I know he would always say, if something was to happen, you and my son would never have to worry about anything, but I never knew what he was talking about, you know. Back then, we used to like run a cord to one of our neighbor's house just to get electricity and run a hose to get water. He wanted us to have the best of life, and I, you know, he told me that he had gotten laid off again, and that probably about the second time he had gotten laid off, and he didn't know what he was going to do because he had just gotten a car through the credit union at Great Dean, and we had just gotten a trailer through the bank, so, you know, and he was very depressed. You know, quiet. He would always stay to himself. Never wanted to go anywhere or anything. But back then, I didn't know nothing about depression. I never knew. Because he would never really talk about certain things, you know. My husband always wanted myself and my son to have like others. And he always would say, you know, I wish I could do more to help you. But I can't, because I don't have a job, you know. And he wanted us to have just like everyone around us had, you know. So. One morning he got up and he told me to take my grandmother to the doctor because he knew I would be willing to do it, and I did, and he gave me the key, and when we got back from the doctor, I took my grandmother home and made sure she was settled down and everything. So me and my girlfriend and my son, we got in the car and went to visit another neighbor. So at that time, I could see my trailer from where I was, you know, stopped talking to a neighbor, and I could see the curtain pulled back, and I said, oh yeah, I see the curtain pulled back. And so when I went in the house, and I took my girlfriend home, and I went in the house, and my son just went to play with the other kids out, you know, in the neighbor. And I just went on in the house, and I thought maybe he was in the back feeding the goats or something like that. And at that time, I just went ahead and started, you know, heating the food up and everything and finished cooking. And then at the time, and my aunt, she knocked on the door and she said, I have a message that your brother-in-law wanted to talk to your husband. He wanted to find out if they going to, you know, plant trees tomorrow. And I say, well, hold on, let me let you talk to him. And I went in the back and I seen where he had changed clothes in the bathroom, because we stayed in the trailer. Then I went to the back door and I called him out and he didn't answer. And I said, well, I think I don't see him. And then I opened the bedroom door, but it was kind of stuck. And I kept pulling on it and I never got an answer. And then when it finally came open, that's when the tragic, I seen him. To the foot of the bed, and I noticed the shotgun to the foot of the bed, and then I noticed his eye was rolled back. It was just like a movie. It just wasn't mean, that movie, but I was there, but it just was stunned and frozen, didn't really know what to do. It was just, and by that time, someone had called the ambulance and called the sheriff department, and the whole hill was just full of everybody, you know. And I remember they told me to sit in the back of the police car, and I sat in the back of the police car until they did their investigation and all. And they came out and said that he had committed suicide. The insurance company got in touch with the funeral director, and they talked to him and asked him, do he thought it was a suicide or accident or whatever. So I think the funeral man did tell him that he probably thought it was an accident. I guess he was telling me in so many words, but, you know, you're young, you don't think about we would do something like that or someone would do something like that, you know, take the life or whatever. And it just, I never really too much thought about it, you know, but I would think about when he would tell us, when he was telling me that you would never have to worry. And then when it came for me to go to the office to find out about, you know, his insurance policy or whatever, they got in contact with me and I went. And I found out it would have expired 12 o'clock that night, February the 1st, when he did it. Every February the 1st, go through it just like it would just freshly happen. On February 1st, and that was my son's birthday. Yeah. And so, February the 1st is fresh. Very fresh. To run away, because it seemed like nobody was there that I could talk to. I could let them know how I felt, and you know, and I was just angry. I had this anger, you know, God, why did you let this happen? You left me with this child I don't even know nothing about raising kids, you know, and I just thought I was just robbed of that. And you know, and I remember at the funeral I was at the castle and I was leading down, telling him, Pete, why did you leave me? I cannot raise my son by myself. Why, you know? And after the funeral, I just decided to get on the bus and go to Atlanta to visit one of my friends. And I was running away. and asked my sister to see about my son until I get back. And when I got on that bus, I said, well, I'm not never coming back. You know, I wasn't even thinking about my son. I loved him, but I was just so angry inside that I was running. Didn't know where I was going, you know, what to do. I didn't have nobody. Just like all my friends had left me alone, and they didn't want to talk to me. And actually, they had out that I have done it. I did that to her and her mama, and that really hurt it because I had to suffer through that, you know. And that really, really hurt it. But I didn't have no way to go. I was running. And I stayed for 2 weeks, and my mom called and she said, Aiden, you have a son here. He wants you, he loves you. I was so afraid, and you know, just felt so alone, so alone. And my uncle, he had a piece of land. He told me I could, you know, move on that, and I stayed there, and I started working, and it was an elderly lady in the neighborhood, and she said, if you don't work, I'll see about your child. You don't know what to do, you know, and everyone don't want to talk about it. You got nobody to talk and tell how you feel or whatever. And so me and my girlfriends, we would, like, go to clubs, and this particular Sunday, I never forget, we went to church and we said, well, we'll go to church and serve God and then serve the devil afterwards. And that's what in our mind we would do, you know. This particular Sunday, and it really did change my life, I went to this club, and they used to call it down on Baker Hill, and it was like a hole in the wall. One of these little rundown clubs, and I met this guy, and we was trying to out dance one another, and so he left, and I told my friends I would be back, that I was going to, you know, to try to talk to him. Before I even got to his place, I had total lost my truck, and I didn't realize it till I woke up, and all I seen was this bright moon, and I heard a dog barking, and I realized that I had wrecked the truck. And I heard the dog barking, and that was my clue to go that way. And that was a home somewhere close because it was a dog barking. And so I must have passed out at his mailbox out to the, by the dirt road. And that's the time when this young man came by. He was coming from the club also. And he said he noticed someone in the road, and he stopped to see, and it was me. And he picked me up and put me in his car because he thought maybe the friend had beaten me up or something. He didn't know what was going on. And so anyway, he took me back to the club, and I couldn't walk. I kept falling and crying and everything. So he went and picked my friends up from the club, because the club was locked. They was on the outside. The people who was running the club, they was then gone, and they was waiting. My friend was waiting on me. They didn't know what was going on. So anyway, And, but I'm so glad my friend wasn't in there. I was there by myself. And through this experience, I knew God was trying to tell me something for my good. And it was for me. Whatever happened, it was for me. They took me to the hospital, and I had a broken pelvic bone and fractures and in my head and everything. So that was the beginning of a changed life for me. And I, by me taking alcohol at that time, they had to stitch my head up and everything. So I had to bear the pain of, you know, the doctor sewing my head up and everything, because they couldn't give me anything because I had alcohol in my system. So, and from then on, I began to see the change, and I began to pray and, you know, laying flat on your back until your pelvic bone healed. It give you time to talk to God, you know. You got no way to look but up to Him. He just began to change my life. Well, I didn't have the desire to go to clubs anymore. I didn't have the desire to drink anymore, you know. I know that God loved me, and He wanted me to do a work for Him. He wasn't ready for me yet. And He wanted me to do a work, so I became a missionary. And I became that missionary, and I've been running ever since.
And what about your son? How did that change your relationship to your son?
Right now he's bitter. Because I was telling him about the torture. And he said, "Well, Mom, you never really sat down to tell me about why he did it or what." And I told him, I said, "I really can't tell you that part because I really don't know." And now he's still kind of bitter. And, you know, he drinks, and I would talk to him and tell him, you know, he don't need to, you know, God gave him a son, that you can raise your son. Your dad didn't raise you until, you know, after 3 years old, you know, he was there for you, but, you know, he went on to be with the Lord. So he given you opportunity to raise your child. And when he would get, like, drinking, he might get stopped, and he would say, "Well, I'm not going back to jail. I got a plan." And his plan was, you know, he'll probably take his life too. Because they say he always, and I said, "No, you don't want to do that." And he get upset when we talk about it.
So your son has threatened that before?
Oh, yes, yes. And he think that's the only way to get out of things, you know, to do things the quick way to end your life. And so I have the opportunity to talk to him and, you know, tell him about getting back into the church and paying his tithes and doing the right thing and raising his son and loving his son.
We eat homemade key lime pie with a cup of coffee and talk for a while about her son, how he still struggles with his father's suicide, about Kalayo and life in the country. The cicadas are still buzzing around us. Live oak trees are garlanded in moss and line the street. Miss Eva May waves from her porch as I drive away. A special thanks to Eva for sharing her story, and to Bibiana Krall for bringing Eva's story to us, for the coffee and the pie and the truly Southern hospitality. Arrivals is written, recorded, and produced on long subway rides up and down the island of Manhattan, on scraps of paper in the bathrooms of day jobs, and in the lovely East Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, by me, Jonathan Hirsch, with help from Nora Lind and Ben Cruz. We have many more stories to share with you, but we need your help. We're currently accepting pitches for the third season of this show, so if you or someone you know has a remarkable story of transformative change, we want to hear from you. Visit our website at arrvls.com and drop us a line. You can also find links there to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We produce a microcast called En Route, which features outtakes, extended interviews, and more from the Arrivals show, which you can find there as well. Arrivals is a proud and founding member of The Herd, an audio collective of independent shows from across North America. This collective has been indispensable to the growth and development of our show. And like our show, The Herd features unique, diverse, and engaging stories from all walks of life. If you like this show, I'm sure that you will enjoy Neighbors, a program where next door hits home. In an upcoming episode, you'll find out why two grown men feel so passionately about giving each other a high five.
If I could summarize, it's a symbol to me of what relationship and commitment look like. And it's a small thing and it seems silly, but it's a symbol of commitment. I am going to go out of my way and out of my time to show you in an intangible way, but also in a physical way by smacking your hand. I'm going to show you that I make time for you.
You can find Neighbors and all the other Herd shows by visiting our website, theherdradio.com, spelled H-E-A-R-D radio. And lastly, if you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have a very special announcement. Arrivals is hosting its first Bay Area shows on the 16th and 17th of October at the Lost Church in San Francisco, and again the following evening as part of the Litquake Literary Festival. The shows will feature works from The Herd's own Vanessa Lowe of the Nocturne podcast, Evan Karp, Sarah Brooke Curtis, whom you may remember from our episode In the Left Pocket by My Heart, along with Layla Day, myself, and Caitlin Prest of The Heart. Seating is limited, so get your tickets now, and information can be found on our website. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.